blessing to be here on this first day of the week. Our study this morning is going to at least try to be a completion of chapter 16 so that Jim will be able to start into chapter 17 on Wednesday night. As I mentioned last Lord's Day, we've been studying the book of Revelation on Wednesday evenings, and I covered chapter 15 last Lord's Day, started into chapter 16 on Wednesday night, but did not finish the chapter. And as a matter of fact, we got down to about verse 13 and some of maybe the most interesting, or what many are most interested in chapter 16. We got to that section, the sixth bowl, and we were not able to finish it. So I did not want to leave that undone, so we're going to be looking at that in the 9 o'clock hour this morning. And for those of you who are not in our class on the book of Revelation, I would expect that you're interested in this sixth bowl as we're introduced to a place here called Armageddon. I want to remind you that what we've been looking at in chapters 15 and 16 is a familiar interlude. We talked about the fact that before the seals were opened, there was a brief moment there where they're able to see that God is in control before the trumpets sound. Again, a brief interlude to show that God is on His throne and that He's in control. And now before the bowls of wrath, we see this beautiful picture of God in the temple of the tabernacle and the smoke billowing forth, and the four living creatures there, the cherubim that are protecting and guarding. And at the same time, we see the seven angels come out of what would to us be a conference room with God with these bowls of wrath. But while it is familiar, it's not identical. What we saw with the trumpets were warnings where a third of each thing was affected, but in this, everything is touched. And so then we compare the seven seals, the seven trumpets, the seven bowls, each one of them being a picture of completion, complete revelation, complete warning, and now complete judgment. We looked at the fact that these seven angels and the seven last plagues are coming out to show the saints that have been praying for God's vindication. Here it is, finally. And this is something they would have been sitting on the edge of their seat waiting to be able to have revealed to them. And that we see them as victors. And now they're standing on the sea of glass, or by it, where before that sea of glass was showing a transcendency to God. Now they've been able to approach God. It is a sea of glass mingled with fire through the suffering and the persecution they've gone through. Being faithful unto death, they have been able to finally approach God in the end. And we see them singing the song of Moses and the Lamb, which is a song of victory, a song of deliverance, because they have found that deliverance of the Lamb. We saw the temple of the tabernacle where God dwells, the seven angels wearing priestly attire, coming out with the seven bowls of wrath, showing God's justice and His righteousness. And the temple is filled with smoke so that no one can enter in, so there is no more intercession. God is doing now what He's going to do, and nothing will stop Him. We saw last week the first bowl was these loathsome sores that broke out and brought tremendous pain to the people. The second bowl, the sea was turned to blood and a foul stench was in the air. Everything in it died. The fresh water in the third bowl was turned to blood. There was nothing to drink. And it was commented that the angel and those praising God commented on the fact that while the beast had desired the blood of the saints, now they would have all the blood that they wanted. The fourth bowl was poured out on the sun and men were scorched. And the fifth bowl, then, we notice, the fifth bowl tells us that darkness was poured out over the kingdom. And we talked on Wednesday night about the fact that this represents moral degradation. And not just the moral degradation of evil and of sin, but the darkness and the blight of one's conscience and of one's knowledge. And the fact that people no longer even seem to know what is right. I want you to turn over to Romans chapter 1. We didn't get to look at this on Wednesday evening. But in Romans chapter 1, you will notice here, he says in verse 18, speaking about the wrath of God, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them." But I want you to notice in verse 21, "Because although they knew God, they did not glorify Him, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools. I want to suggest to you that this is what was happening in Rome, and God poured this out upon them. And then it says in verse 24, therefore God also gave them over to uncleanness, to the lust of their heart, to dishonor their bodies among themselves. Notice, God gave them over to this. He poured out this darkness. They're going to suffer the consequence of that darkness. When we talk about the act of church discipline, the Holy Spirit says in 1 Corinthians 5 that we are delivering such a one to Satan. What does that mean? They want darkness. They can have it. They can see what it's like to live in darkness. You know, typically people that want evil, they only want a touch of it. They want it like salt and pepper, spiced up here and there. But they don't want to live in the filth of darkness. They just want a touch of it. That's not the way that it works. When a person wants darkness, God will give them over to darkness. And then he goes on and says in verse 26, for this reason, God gave them up to the vile passions, for even their women exchange the natural use of what is against nature. Likewise, men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burn in their lust for one another, men with men, committing what is shameful, and receiving in themselves the penalty of their error, which is due. Rome was known for this, the sin of homosexuality, and it is represented here as God giving them up to this darkness, to where they didn't just have it in part. They went completely into it. And then in verse 28, and even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to what? A debased mind, to do those things which are not fitting. Over and over again, we're seeing these examples of where God gives them up or gives them over to these various things. And this is a way that darkness works in a person's life. Notice in 2 Thessalonians 2, and then we'll move on. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, in verse 9, the Holy Spirit says, the coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan with all power, signs, and lying wonders. Now, this is what we're seeing in chapter 16, where these deceiving spirits go out. And the power, the working of Satan with all power, signs, and lying wonders, with all unrighteous deception among those who perish. Why? Because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. They didn't want the light. So what happens? Verse 11, and for this reason, God will send them what? Strong delusions. That's the darkness that's poured out. And I'll tell you, we better take warning of this. Because while the book of Revelation is a revelation that Satan will never be able to use a worldwide power again to persecute saints, this fact that God pours out darkness on those who seek darkness is true even in an individual realm. And that's what Paul is writing about here in 2 Thessalonians. He will send them strong delusion. He'll pour out that darkness. May we always love the light, or we'll find out what it's like to not even remember what we once knew. For this reason, God will send them strong delusion, that they should believe the lie, and that they all may be condemned who did not believe the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. That describes Rome. And that describes this fifth bowl that is poured out upon them. We looked at the fifth bowl on Wednesday night, so I want to move on now to the sixth bowl. In the sixth bowl, I want you to notice here in verse 12, then the sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river Euphrates, and its water was dried up, so that the way of the kings from the east might be prepared. We talked about the fact that, again, I want to remind you that the loathsome sores, the darkness, the sea to blood, the rivers and springs to blood, none of this is literal. Remember, the book has told us in chapter 1 and in verse 1 that these, all the things that we read here were signified. That is, they were revealed by means of symbols, not literal things, but symbols. So all of these bowls are symbolic of God's wrath. And so here we see the drying up of the great river Euphrates. You say, well, did that happen? Well, it's not that God can't dry up a river. He's done it plenty of times. But that's not what happened. The Euphrates did not literally dry up. That is symbolic. The Euphrates was that great barrier that kept the kings from the east from invading Rome. And what he's saying is God is going to work providentially and make it to where they are able to invade. And this would represent the kings of the east would be the Parthians that constantly fought against Rome and eventually overthrew them with this external invasion. But now notice in verse 13, "And I saw three unclean spirits like frogs coming out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, and out of the mouth of the false prophet, for they are spirits of demons, performing signs which go out to the kings of the earth and the whole world to gather them to the battle of that great day of God Almighty." Then he warns in verse 15, "Behold, I am coming as a thief. Blessed is he who watches and keeps his garments, lest he should walk naked and they see his shame." Now, this is a passage that we've heard Jesus say before, that where he is referencing the final judgment, his second and last coming. But clearly this is being applied to a temporal judgment, a judgment against the nation of Rome or the empire of Rome. And once again, he is reminding saints not to be overwhelmed with the facade of power of Rome, and not to give up and to allow their garments to be defiled because they think that nothing's ever going to change. Jesus said, when you least expect it, when you think that there's no way that Rome's going to be defeated, no way that Jesus is going to finally and totally rule, that's when I'm going to come. So don't give up. So then he comes back. That's just a parenthetical statement. He comes back in verse 16, "And they gathered them together to the place called in Hebrew Armageddon." So in this sixth bowl, really what we have poured out is a way is prepared for external invasion. That was the sixth bowl. The way is prepared for external invasion. So what happens as a result of that? You know, in some of the other bowls, we're just told what God did. But with this one, we're told what Satan did in response to that. Clearly, he saw the chess game, at least after a move was made. He didn't know ahead of time. God foiled him at every turn. But after God moves his knight or his queen, now Satan sees the way of invasion is opened up. The end is soon. Satan has a limited amount of time to finally and completely destroy Christianity. When he sees this sixth bowl, he knows it's almost over for his beast that's doing his bidding. So he turns it up. And so now we see these spirits that appear symbolically as frogs coming out of the mouth of the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. What are they for? Well, it says here that they are to gather the kings together for war. Now, this isn't the war with the kings of the east. This isn't a literal war with the Parthians. This is the war against God. That's what this book is all about. And so what the dragon is doing is he sees that his beast, his servant, Rome, is about to be destroyed, and so he is garnering everything he can for this great battle, this day of the Lord, and he's hoping that he's going to finally snuff out and destroy Christianity. So realize that this is symbolic. Too many times we know it's symbolic, but we get caught up and we lose sight of the forest for the trees, and we start thinking, oh, he's trying to gather up troops for a literal battle because of this external invasion. No. The external invasion is going to overthrow Rome, the Parthians. Satan knows that. That's not the battle he's worried about. The battle he's worried about is with God, and that's what he's marshaling forces for. So this is the picture that we're given. And they gathered them together. This isn't about the Parthians. This is about Satan marshaling forces to defeat God, to defeat Christ, to defeat Christianity. And it is that battle against God, between Satan and God, where the allies and all of those that would support Satan are gathered together to the place called in Hebrew Armageddon. So let's establish that first. What is Armageddon? You know, this word seems to thunder doom and destruction in the minds of most people. There's a movie entitled Armageddon. You know, we were talking about the fact that apocalyptic literature, which simply means literature that is taught or conveyed by symbolism or signs, but now the word apocalyptic to most people means end of times. It means destruction and doom, but that's not what the word means. It means symbolic. And likewise, the term Armageddon. It has a symbolic meaning, but it has come to mean the end of times, the end of everything as we know it. But that is not what was being conveyed here. When we hear the Battle of Armageddon, we are often told by premillennialists that this is an unprecedented battle involving millions of soldiers. It's going to bring an end to the world as we know it. The center of the global conflict is to be in the Valley of Megiddo. And this is a valley that runs east and west along the ancient border between Samaria and Galilee. Many of you have heard of a man named Hal Lindsey that through the 70s and 80s wrote many books about this premillennial conflict. He wrote a book entitled The 1980s Countdown to Armageddon. That's interesting to us now because my kids think that that was ancient. But there was a time when that was in the future. And I remember that time. And in this book, he presents this current popular view. And he writes that the final great war known as Armageddon will involve the destruction of one-third of the world's population through a nuclear holocaust, and that this event will occur during the lifetime of those now on the earth. Now, what's interesting is that what premillennialists will do is they will take this one word and then they will run to other passages that speak nothing about Armageddon, and they will pull snippets from verses and they will construct a battle. They will construct an idea that is completely unbiblical. Where does he get this one-third of the earth? Oh, that was in the trumpet. That was in the trumpet blast. Remember, those seven trumpets affected one-third? But this isn't the trumpets. This is the bowls of wrath. And it's not one-third. It is everything. You see how illogical and unbiblical this approach is that the premillennialist takes to this. Does the Bible teach this kind of a view? Is there going to be a great battle between the Russians and the Chinese, or maybe now the North Koreans and others, that is going to end this age? And will it happen in our time? What does the Bible actually say about Armageddon? I want us to realize, first of all, when we talk about this place called Armageddon, what we need to understand is that the Scripture says here in verse 16 that they gathered them together in the place which in Hebrew is called Armageddon, or actually Harmageddon. John is told that the false prophet here and the beast bring together all the armies of the kings of the earth to fight against God. And this word Armageddon is actually a Hebrew term that means mountain of Megiddo. As I said earlier, Megiddo is a valley that makes a natural pass in the mountains for all the traffic that would go between Egypt and any point to the north or to the east. Every empire of Bible times tried to control this valley because it was strategic. It was important. And interestingly, while there is a valley of Megiddo, there is no mountain of Megiddo. So why would the Bible say that they were gathered together at the mountain of Megiddo? That's what Harmageddon means. Mount Megiddo, or the mountain of Megiddo. Why would he say that if there is no geographical place on a map where you will find a mountain of Megiddo? You find a valley, but that's the opposite of a mountain. Am I mistaken here? So why would he call it Mount Megiddo? Because it's not a literal place. It's not a literal battlefield. That is the one of the first things that shows us that this is symbolic. Armageddon's symbolic name just points to the nature of the book of Revelation. It's not a book to be taken literally. It is, as we've established, an apocalyptic book, a kind of literature that portrays a battle between good and evil in all of these fascinating signs and symbols that we've been seeing. A beast, and now frogs, and a dragon. Armageddon-type battles are actually not unusual in apocalyptic literature. Even in non-biblical apocalyptic literature, we find this in one of the Dead Sea Scrolls, not one that was an account that is a part of the Bible, but one of the Dead Sea Scrolls involves one of these apocalyptic battles like Armageddon. And so Revelation's battle is no different than those that have been in other apocalyptic literature. The Battle of Armageddon is the big picture look at God overcoming all of those who oppose Him and His people. And to make it all literal is to make a fatal mistake that's going to deprive all of us of any real understanding of what is happening in the book of Revelation. So as we look here at this battle of Armageddon, let us notice that there is, first of all, only one verse in the Bible that uses this word. As much as it is written about and talked about, you would think that the battle of Armageddon would be spoken about throughout the Bible. Only one verse mentions Armageddon. And if this verse does not teach what premillennialists claim, then their interpretation of this and of other passages, which they say are about the battle, must be incorrect. So as we saw here in Revelation 16 and verses 13 through 16, we find verse 16 that is the only verse that speaks about Armageddon. I want you to realize that, as we've been pointing out, this is a figurative and not a literal passage. There is absolutely nothing in this verse that is going to give us a literal point here. Got ahead of myself there in my notes. So, as we look at the figurative concept of this particular passage, I want us to understand that as we begin into Revelation chapter 16, we need to look at the context. And as we said, first of all, it pictures two beasts and three frogs. Three frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, the seven-headed beast, which represents the empire of Rome, and the second beast, or the false prophet, as he is later referred to. And they go as messengers to ask kings to gather for war at a place called Armageddon. Again, we've got to be careful that we don't think that this is gathering people for a literal battle. This is an effort to get martial forces to destroy Christianity in this battle against God. What are these three frogs that come out of the mouth of the dragon and out of the mouth of the beast and of the false prophet? We pointed out on Wednesday night that it says that they are spirits of demons. Notice that in verse 14. For they are spirits of demons, performing signs which go out to the kings of the earth and the whole world to gather them to the battle. So, and it says that they are deceptive. I want you to look with me over in 1 Timothy chapter 4. In 1 Timothy chapter 4, I think that we'll read about something similar. He says here in verse 1, "Now the Spirit expressly says that in latter times some will depart from the faith, giving heed to deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons." Deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons. So they are spirits of demons. And what are they? Those are doctrines of demons. And I want you to realize that the term translated spirit there and the term translated spirit here is one and the same. And they are both spirits of demons. And it's interesting that they come out of the mouth of the dragon and out of the mouth of the beast and out of the mouth of the false prophet. What is it? Lies, blasphemies, and propaganda. That's what the false prophet, the land beast, was for. He was the concilia that was in Asia that was used to lie to people and to convince them that Caesar was a god and to enforce emperor worship there. And so what all this is saying with these frogs, a frog is a detestable creature, and all this is saying is that when Satan sees the incoming, he redoubles his efforts through his natural MO, which is deception and lies, to try to destroy Christianity. That has always been the battle line of the faith, is it not? Now, certainly Satan has used persecution, but that is not working to his favor. And so he's going to use the best instrument that he's got to defeat truth, which is a lie. And obviously there are plenty of people, as we saw before, that do not love the truth. So he is making that effort. All this stuff about frogs and about kings and all this stuff, all it's saying is Satan is trying to win this battle against God with deception and lies and spirits of demons. And so then we notice that this battle between truth and error is at a symbolic place called Armageddon. Now, we know that the dragon is a symbol for Satan. We saw that back in chapter 12 and in verse 9, and we'll see it again in chapter 20 and in verse 2. And the premillennialist even agrees about this. It's interesting that a premillennialist will say figurative, figurative, literal, and very inconsistent in their interpretation. It's either figurative or it's literal. And the whole book is revealed to us as being figurative or symbolic, apocalyptic, signs and symbols. The seven-headed beast that we see here, a frog coming out of his mouth, is a worldwide political kingdom that persecutes Christians and forces the worship of its ruler. That beast symbolizes the Roman Empire, and the premillennialist agrees with that. However, if you're talking to a premillennialist about this being Rome, they believe that it represents a Roman Empire, but they say that since Christ did not set up his earthly kingdom while he was here, which is a lie, not true, according to the Bible, they say that the first Roman Empire, or since it wasn't done in the first Roman Empire, that Roman Empire will have to be revived. So be aware of that. The false prophet, or the two-horned lamb, the land beast, the second beast of Revelation 13, is said to rise with the seven-headed beast. We saw that in chapter 13. And he's also said to go down to defeat with him in chapter 19. We'll see that later. And the sole function of that false prophet is to require worship of one of the heads, or one of the kings of the seven-headed beast. So that would mean that the false prophet enforces emperor worship. The main characters introduced here then are symbolic. That's the point I want you to see. The dragon is symbolic of Satan. The seven-headed beast is symbolic of a Roman Empire. The two-horned beast, or the false prophet, is symbolic of the concilia, which enforced, it was a group that Rome established to enforce emperor worship. And the frogs are symbolic of the doctrines and the lies of demons. So then what would we conclude? This passage is highly figurative. To try to put the Chinese army or Iran or intercontinental ballistic missiles in here is absolutely unbiblical, inconsistent, against the context, and absurd, frankly. It doesn't fit with anything else that we found in this. And in this passage, the figures relating to Rome, they actually picture the ancient Roman Empire, not a revived Roman Empire. There's nothing in these verses that would suggest that the beasts do not represent the first and the only Roman Empire. As a matter of fact, many times in the book of Revelation, John is told that he's speaking of events that will happen soon after the time that he wrote. The very first book, verse of Revelation, it makes that fact very clear. This will shortly come to pass. And this phrase is used a lot of other places. In verse 3, the time is at hand. And in chapter 22 and in verse 6, the things which shall shortly come to pass. In chapter 22 and in verse 7, I come quickly. In chapter 22 and in verse 10, seal not up the words of the prophecy of this book, for the time is at hand. Again in chapter 22, in verse 12 and in verse 20, I come quickly. So either the fundamental message of the book of Revelation happened soon after it was written, which was near the end of the first century A.D., or Jesus was just mistaken in saying that these events would happen soon. I don't think that any genuine Bible student can accept that Jesus was mistaken. So all of this fits perfectly if the beast represents the first Roman Empire, but it is way outside the mark if it's applied to some revival 2,000 years later. Now, the verses leading up to the Armageddon verse then speak of Satan and his two allies, the Roman Empire and the enforcers of emperor worship. And what do those three do? We see that they are trying to destroy Christianity through these spirits of demons. They're marshaling forces to try to conquer and to defeat God. And they are preparing for this final battle. Now, I want you to also notice that the passages suggest that there is this gathering of forces to try to help the cult of emperor worship. These things happen after the pouring out of the sixth bowl. As I said, Satan sees that that Rome's end is coming because of the outside invasion is imminent. And so he's trying to do everything he can to strengthen the emperor worship that is here. The entire book of Revelation really answers the question that's being put by early Christians. Why are we going through this persecution? Is it worth it to stand for Jesus and refuse to worship the emperor? And if I give my life for Jesus, what will happen to me? His answer, Jesus in his answer describes the fall of Rome using the same symbols that are taken from the fall of Egypt. Something that they could relate to. An unimaginable victory of God's people. Now, I want to remind you, we're talking about the world power of Egypt that was actually pillaged. The children of Israel actually took their goods with them like you would if you conquered a nation. They took their goods with them. The Egyptians gave them their goods to get out of the land. But still, God in His work, they took their goods, they left, and then the army was destroyed. That's a victory. And it was done by unarmed slaves. Unarmed slaves defeated the world power. So He is using that event and symbols from that event to point back to what is happening now. As the first four bowls are poured out, nature seems to turn against Rome. The land, the seas, the river, the objects in the air are affected by the plagues. All four spheres of nature. And as a matter of fact, in Gibbon's book on Rome and its decline, actually says that natural disasters like plagues and floods and earthquakes and famines, drought, locusts, epidemics, they were principal contributors to the weakening of Rome. The fifth bowl brings darkness. The pouring out of the sixth bowl brings the invasion of these armies. And under the figures of the six bowls being poured out on the kingdom of the beast, John is predicting the downfall of the great persecutor of the church. As Satan sees the weakening of the Roman Empire, which was his agent for persecuting Christianity, and he sees that he's not going to be able to defeat Christianity through persecution, he marshals the forces to deceive. And they gather to a place called Armageddon. We pointed out the fact that Armageddon is a symbolic place because in this valley was where Deborah and Barak defeated Sisera in Judges 4 and Judges 5. Gideon's 300 men routed the thousands of Midianites. Saul was defeated. You say, well, that was some of God's people. No, Saul was in rebellion against God. And while God used a foreign nation, it was still God that was gaining the victory. The same was true with Pharaoh Necho, the Egyptian that defeated Josiah, who was a good king, but God had already said that he was going to judge Israel and he was going to use another nation to do it. And Pharaoh Necho even said that he received a message that he was on an errand for God, and he was. The Valley of Megiddo represents over and over again God winning and defeating those that would rebel against Him. It is a symbolic place, and it was to the hearers. If we were to say that President so-and-so met his Waterloo on this particular issue, we might be talking about health care or about a foreign affair or something like that. If we said he met his Waterloo, what would we mean? Waterloo was certainly a literal battlefield, but this president didn't go there. It is symbolic of a catastrophic defeat, one that wasn't expected. And by that same token, that's what Armageddon represents, a defeat of evil. And this very symbolic sense has to be recognized if we're going to understand John's use of the term Armageddon. He's already spoken six woes on Rome, which meant that forces were already at work to weaken the Roman Empire. And as a way of suggesting that Satan wouldn't let his powerful ally go down without a fight, Satan is pictured here as gathering his forces to resist God's plan. Again, the fight between God and Satan is not a physical war. It's not a physical war fought at a literal place called Megiddo. It is simply symbolic of evil fighting against good. Again, in the midst of the symbols for Satan, a dragon, the Roman Empire, a beast with seven heads, and the emperor, a worship cult, a lamb with two horns, and the doctrines of demons being frogs, we have a symbol for the nature of this gathering, which is called Armageddon. Chapters 17 and 18 of Revelation are going to briefly speak about the city of Rome as a harlot, and we're going to see how she is misled for her lover kings in the persecution of the saints, and because of that, she's going to be defeated by God. Now, why should we take Armageddon as figurative? The entire passage is symbolic. We've already looked at that. It talks about a dragon, unusual beasts, and three frogs. The use of the name Armageddon, then, should be taken as symbolic for a decisive struggle between the forces of God and the forces of evil, rather than an actual location. With the pouring out of the bowls of wrath, God says the time of the end for Rome will start soon, and once it starts, nothing is going to stop this process. And that struggle is pictured here with the wording that is used. The defeat is pictured as God's doings as He makes the harlot city of Rome drink the cup of wine of the fierceness of His wrath. See how symbolic that is? In chapter 19, the defeat of the two beasts is again pictured, but now they're defeated by, this time, a rider on a white horse whose only weapon is a sword that proceeds out of his mouth. Chapter 19 and verse 15. The sword is obviously not a weapon of carnal warfare. It is a weapon of spiritual conflict. We see that in Ephesians 6:17, the Word of God being the sword of the Spirit. And it is by the sword that He's going to judge His enemies. The events that follow the call of the kings to Armageddon clearly establish this event does not mark the end of our time. Because even after we are told here in verse 21, it is done, and the city is broken into three pieces, and the hail falls 100 pounds each, you know what happens? Men blaspheme God. If it was over, if this was the end, there would be no blaspheming. There would be no people left. There is no mention here of a coming of Christ. Instead, life is continuing after the last plague. Men still have the opportunity to blaspheme God. So whatever is being described through the figures of the two beasts had to happen within a short span of time after the writing of Revelation. We've seen that in the message. Our age will not end with a series of events. Here's another reason we know that this has to be figurative, and it has to be related to that first century. Because our age will not end with a series of events which will allow us to know when we are 7 years and then 3.5 years away from that end. There are at least 10 passages of Scripture where Jesus said, no one will know when that end comes. So to say that there's going to be a battle that's the end of time and that this sign is going to mark 7 years before it happens is absurd. That would make Jesus wrong on every account when He said we wouldn't know. All the verses of Jesus speaking, Matthew 26:36, Matthew 24:44, Matthew 24:50, Matthew 25:13, and so on, tell us that we will not know. What does Armageddon tell us? It tells us that God is going to win and that Satan and his helpers will lose. The lesson then, the most important lesson to be learned from studying about Armageddon, is that God will triumph. And it is about good and evil. It is about Satan trying to destroy Christianity, and what we're going to find out in chapter 19 and 20 is he lost. He lost that battle, and Christianity is still alive and well today. Well, notice also in closing the seventh bowl, which we never got to. The seventh angel poured out his bowl, verse 17 of chapter 16, into the air, and a loud voice came out of the temple of heaven from the throne saying, "It is done." I want to remind you that pouring it out into the air, where is Satan's dominion? He's the prince of power of the air, Ephesians 2 and in verse 2. It was poured out upon his place of power. The power behind all of this, the God of this world, is also struck. And God says it is done. What has taken place here, though, I want to point out, is merely an outline. When we look at chapter 16 and these seven bowls of wrath, they are a brief outline of the downfall of the Roman Empire. What's going to happen is that we're going to see some other things. We're going to see some more details. Chapter 17 is going to give us more details about this particular time and what this particular battle. Chapter 19 is going to tell us the details about the Battle of Armageddon. Chapter 20 is going to tell us more details about the downfall of the dragon and of the beast. So all we have in chapter 16 is a brief outline about how God did it. And the seventh bowl is simply the finality. The city was divided into three parts or three portions. What does that speak about? The completeness of its destruction. Something breaks in half, you glue it back together. If it breaks in more than two pieces, it's much harder to put back together. It is the completeness of Rome's destruction. Earthquake, lightnings and voices and thunders, all of these are symbolic of God's wrath and of His divine judgment that is brought down upon them. The islands and the mountains fled. They go away. What do they represent? They represent Rome's strongholds and any place of refuge. God took them away. Nothing is going to save them at this point. They are going to be destroyed. Hailstones, the weight of a talent, that's about 100 pounds. Not literal. It's telling us, again, that harkens back to an Egyptian plague where God has the power to destroy anything He wants to destroy. The Israelites were not touched by the hailstones in the Egyptian plague. All of this is an outline of God's defeat of the Roman Empire. And as we get to chapter 17, now we're going to start looking at the details of how God did that. Well, hopefully we've answered some of your questions about these bowls of wrath and about the battle of Armageddon. If you still have questions about it, I'd be happy to visit with you further. We're going to be dismissed now for our Bible classes, but first we want to close with a word of prayer. If you will, bow with me, please.